We would like to send out a special thanks to Native for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Native makes safe, simple, effective products that people use in the bathroom every day with trusted ingredients and trusted performance. For 20% off your first purchase, please visit nativedeodorant.com and enter the promo code COLD during checkout. That's nativedeodorant.com and the promo code is COLD. Thank you and enjoy the show. December 27th, 1928. Orville, Ohio. 4-year-old Melvin Horse leaves his house to play in the neighborhood with friends, but never returns home, and a search of the area fails to turn up any trace of him. Over the course of the next 2 years, a number of different suspects would be arrested after allegations surface that Melvin's disappearance was orchestrated by bootleggers as revenge against his uncle for enforcing prohibition. While 2 suspects are convicted of Melvin's presumed abduction, their sentences are overturned, and even though there are a number of reported sightings of Melvin to suggest he might still be alive, the truth about what happened to him remains unknown. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to kick off the month of December with an unsolved missing children's case which took place over 90 years ago, the 1928 disappearance of 4-year-old Melvin Horst. As you probably know, it's pretty much an annual tradition for The Trail Went Cold to spend December covering holiday-themed mysteries which occurred around Christmas time. This particular story took place 2 days after Christmas, and in a cruel twist of fate, the victim was playing with a new toy he had received as a gift when he disappeared. This is considered to be the oldest active missing persons case in the state of Ohio, and when I first delved into it, I had no idea how crazy this story really was. Most of you are probably familiar with the abduction of 20-month-old Charles Lindbergh Jr., which took place in March of 1932, and became perhaps the most sensational kidnapping case of all time. The story of Melvin Horst is nowhere near as well known today, probably because the Lindbergh case overshadowed it, but when it originally took place, Melvin's disappearance captivated the entire nation. And while the body of the Lindbergh baby was eventually found, Melvin was not, and it's unclear how long he might have lived after he originally went missing. Since Melvin's uncle was the town marshal who strictly enforced prohibition, the most prominent theory is that the boy was kidnapped by bootleggers as some sort of revenge scheme. But even though a number of people would be arrested, charged, convicted, and even make confessions to Melvin's abduction, there really was no evidence to conclusively implicate anyone, and no one could even be certain if Melvin was dead or still alive somewhere. Believe it or not, even though this case is nearly a century old, it is still being actively investigated by law enforcement, so I think it would be an interesting holiday-themed mystery to cover on the podcast. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the unsolved disappearance of Melvin Horst. Our story begins in 1928 in Orville, Ohio, a small railroad and manufacturing town located in Wayne County, which had a population of around 4,500 people at that time. Our central figure is 4-year-old Melvin Horst, who lives with his family at their residence at the corner of Vine Street and Paradise Street. Melvin's parents are Raymond and Zora Horst, and he has two siblings, his 8-year-old brother Ralph and his 2-year-old sister Elgie. The Horst family had celebrated a nice Christmas together and still had their Christmas tree up when Melvin decided to leave the house to go out and play on the afternoon of December 27th. He brought along a red toy truck he had received as a Christmas gift and went off with some of his young friends from the neighborhood. At 5:30 p.m., Zora Horst went out and called Melvin for dinner, but she received no response and he did not return home. Concern grew, and Zora noticed that Melvin's toy truck was lying in the front yard, but Melvin himself was nowhere to be found. When Raymond Horst arrived home from work, the entire family started searching the neighborhood for Melvin. Some boys would tell them that they had been playing with Melvin in a vacant lot located near the railroad tracks. Once darkness started falling at around 5:15, Melvin's friends were summoned home for dinner, so Melvin told them he was going to head back home as well. The lot was just over a block away from the Horst residence and would have required Melvin to walk down a 1,000-foot alleyway, but something apparently happened to him before he made it home. When Melvin could not be found by 7 o'clock, his family contacted the authorities, and a search effort would be initiated when the town's fire bell was rung in order to alert residents that a child was missing. The search would be led by Melvin's uncle, Roy Horst, who also worked as the town marshal. Many people would spend the next several weeks looking for the child, which involved searches of houses in Melvin's neighborhood, as well as nearby wooded areas and ponds, but they were unable to find any trace of him. Melvin's disappearance would soon wind up making nationwide headlines, becoming one of the biggest news stories in the country, and the Horst family made a vow not to take down their Christmas tree until Melvin returned home. This would continue on for a very long time, and whenever a tree died, they would just replace it with a new one, no matter what time of year it was. A photograph of a tearful Zora Horst sitting in front of the Christmas tree with her daughter Elgie would be featured in newspapers everywhere. Investigators started exploring the possibility that Melvin's disappearance may have been a ransom kidnapping. The Horsts were just an ordinary working-class family, as Raymond supported them by working as a roofer, and they did not have a great deal of money. However, one of their neighboring families was fairly wealthy, and since the family had a boy around Melvin's age who resembled him, one theory was that Melvin may have been the victim of mistaken identity. No ransom demand ever came in, but on January 2nd, 1929, another family from the neighborhood would be arrested for their alleged roles in Melvin's abduction. The patriarch of this family was 60-year-old Elias Arnold, who was taken into custody alongside his two sons, 30-year-old William and 17-year-old Arthur, as well as his 20-year-old daughter, Dorothy McHenry, and Dorothy's husband, Bascom McHenry. The Arnolds lived just around the corner from the Horst residence, and right next to the alleyway Melvin would have walked through on his route home. Their alleged motive for abducting Melvin may have been related to his uncle, Roy Horst. As you probably know, 1928 was in the midst of the United States' Prohibition era when alcohol was banned. As town marshal, Roy Horst was known for being very strict about enforcing the local liquor laws, which made him his fair share of enemies. The Arnold family did not have the best reputation in the community and had a history of run-ins with the law, as Elias was involved in bootlegging. Roy had played a role in arresting Elias and ensuring that he spent a good chunk of the previous year in jail, so it was theorized that the Arnolds had taken Melvin as some sort of revenge scheme. Roy was known for being very close to his nephew, and had actually lived with Melvin's parents at their residence until a short time before the child went missing, so someone could have mistakenly believed that Roy was Melvin's father. The Arnolds' arrest was made possible by an 8-year-old boy named Charles Hanna Jr., who went by the nickname Jr., and his father, Charles Hanna Sr., just happened to be Elias Arnold's brother-in-law. 4 days after Melvin originally went missing, Junior told police he had seen Arthur Arnold approach Melvin and offer him an orange when he was walking through the alleyway. After Melvin took a bite out of the orange, he accidentally dropped it, so Arthur grabbed him and took him into his house. Shortly thereafter, Junior saw Arthur and Elias taking Melvin out of the house and placing him in a car before they drove away. A search of the furnace inside the Arnold residence turned up some bones which were initially reported as being human, but it turned out they were chicken bones. However, an orange with a bite mark on it was found on the Arnolds' property, which seemed to corroborate Junior's story about Melvin dropping it. The Arnolds denied any involvement in Melvin's disappearance, and it turned out that three members of the family seemed to have rock-solid alibis. William, Dorothy, and Bascom had been having dinner at an aunt's house around the time Melvin went missing, before they went to a basketball game in the town of Fredericksburg, so the charges against them were eventually dropped. Elias and Arthur's alibis during that time period were that they were home together, but since they only had each other to vouch for their whereabouts, this did not clear them. The local prosecutor managed to convince a grand jury that Elias and Arthur had lured Melvin into their home because they mistakenly believed he was Roy Horse's son, so they were both charged with child stealing. This was a lesser offense than kidnapping, as Ohio state law at the time stipulated that one could only be charged with kidnapping if there was evidence they took the victim across state lines. In fact, this was the reason the FBI could not get involved in the investigation, as it could not be proven that Melvin was ever taken out of the state. Even though Melvin could still not be found, the Arnolds both went on trial in March of 1929, but their defense attorney attempted to tear apart the prosecution's case, which hinged almost entirely on Junior Hanna's eyewitness testimony. Other evidence was provided by a jailhouse informant named Mike Millich, who had been Elias's cellmate after he was arrested. Millich testified that he overheard Elias being told by a visitor that Melvin had been wearing a big cap when he went missing. Millich also said that Arthur was being held in a cell above theirs, and that he saw Elias whisper to Arthur through a hole in the ceiling, quote, "Tell Mum to burn all the caps in the house." But the defense would bring up serious questions about the orange, which was supposedly found on the Arnolds' property. A patrolman would testify that he had performed a search of the property shortly after Melvin went missing and did not see an orange, which seemed to imply that it had been planted there at a later time. Elias would take the stand to testify in his own defense, and while he admitted to having a grudge against Roy Horst, he denied that he would ever hurt a child and stated, quote, "If I wanted to get even with Marshall Horst, I'd take it out of his skin." Nevertheless, likely due to the Arnolds' less than stellar reputations, the jury still found Elias and Arthur guilty of child stealing. Elias would receive a 20-year sentence in the Ohio State Penitentiary, and since Arthur was still only 17 years old, he was sent to a reformatory. However, only 3 months later, both men's convictions would be overturned by the 9th District Court of Appeals after the defense successfully argued that Junior Hanna's story was not credible. In fact, it turned out that he changed his story no less than 5 times before he testified at trial, and in his initial statement, Junior never even mentioned Melvin eating an orange. The most troubling discrepancy is that Junior had initially implicated Bascom McHenry in the abduction and stated that he saw both Bascom and Arthur carrying Melvin out of the house together. But after being visited by 2 detectives, Junior changed his statement and now said that he saw Arthur and Elias carrying Melvin instead, which is the story he shared at trial. It seemed apparent that police had discovered that Bascom had an airtight alibi, which is why they told Junior to implicate Elias instead. In addition, when Junior's father, Charles Hanna Sr., was originally questioned and asked to account for his whereabouts around the time Melvin went missing, Charles said that Junior was already at home eating supper with them, but he later recanted that statement for unknown reasons. Elias and Arthur received a new trial, which began in December, and this time, when Junior took the stand to testify, he was asked why it took him 4 days to report having witnessed the Arnolds abducting Melvin. Junior's response was simply, quote, "Because nobody asked me." Now that the credibility of Junior's story had been shattered, there really was no other evidence to implicate Elias or Arthur, so when the case went to the jury this time around, both men were acquitted and released. Well, it'd only be 2 months later, in February of 1930, when the police arrested 2 more men for abducting Melvin, and believe it or not, this would take place after Junior changed his story again and implicated a very unlikely suspect, his own father, Charles Hanna Sr. In addition, Charles Sr. would be arrested alongside one of his neighbors, a railroad worker named Earl Connold. According to Junior, Earl had told him to bring Melvin to a garage, and when Junior did so, Both Earl and Charles Sr. were waiting for him. The two men sent Junior away and closed the garage door, but while he was leaving, Junior thought he could hear the sound of Melvin whining, followed by a loud thud. Junior never saw Melvin again, but he claimed that his father told him to make up a story implicating the Arnold family, which is why he came forward 4 days later. Even though Elias Arnold was Charles' brother-in-law, they were also allegedly rival bootleggers, which is why Charles wanted him out of the way. While Charles and Earl were both taken in by law enforcement and interrogated for days before they each confessed to being involved in Melvin's disappearance. But the problem is that their confessions contradicted each other, and neither one of them would take responsibility for harming Melvin. According to Charles, he just happened to be inside the garage with Earl drinking some liquor and was taken by complete surprise when his son brought Melvin there. Charles then proceeded to witness Earl choke Melvin before he struck the boy on the head. By contrast, Earl's story was that Charles orchestrated the whole thing and that he was the innocent bystander who witnessed it. Earl claimed that Charles was a bootlegger and that he was one of his regular customers who was simply drinking liquor inside the garage when he witnessed Charles attack Melvin. Well, after further interrogation, Charles finally took full responsibility for killing Melvin and signed a statement in which he confessed to burying the boy's body in his backyard. The police excavated Charles's property and found nothing, and it wasn't long before Charles changed his story again. He now claimed that Melvin's disappearance was orchestrated by Tony LaFatch, an organized crime figure from Akron, Ohio. Charles said that LaFatch had hired him to kidnap Melvin in exchange for 25 gallons of liquor, and that the whole thing was a revenge scheme against Roy Horst for interfering with LaFatch's bootlegging operations. According to Charles, when Junior brought Melvin to the garage, he struck Melvin on the head with a 2x4 before placing his body inside a sack. Two of LaFatch's men soon showed up, who then placed Melvin's body in their car and drove away. Charles said that Earl Connell was present when this took place, but he was warned not to talk about what happened before he ran away. Tony LaFatch was soon taken into custody and questioned. He did admit to being in Orrville on the day of Melvin's disappearance because he often sold liquor to the town's residents, but he denied knowing Charles Hanna or having any involvement with what happened to Melvin. Interestingly, LaFatch drove a green car, and that same day, residents had recalled seeing a green car driven through the area by a man who stopped to ask for directions, and a woman with a crying child could be seen in the back seat. But other than Charles's confession, there was no corroborating evidence against LaFatch, so he was never charged. Well, even though Melvin's body could not be found, Charles Hanna and Earl Connold were still charged with murder and child stealing, but Charles soon recanted his confession again, and now claimed he was 100% innocent. Charles claimed that after the police had kept him awake for 36 consecutive hours, he decided to fabricate a story and sign a statement because it was the only way they would allow him to get some sleep. Indeed, at a hearing in which Charles pleaded not guilty, his defense attorney pointed out some deep marks on his client's thumbs, which seemed to indicate that Charles's interrogators had literally hanged him by his thumbs in order to get him to confess. In the end, there was just no other evidence to make a case against Charles or Earl, so the charges against them were eventually dropped, and they were both released. The investigation into Melvin's disappearance came to a standstill, and while there were a number of reported sightings of him over the course of the next decade, none of them panned out. In 1940, the governor of Ohio personally ordered the investigation to be reopened after a farmer and his wife came forward and shared a particularly interesting sighting. The couple claimed that in the spring of 1929, an oil field worker and reputed bootlegger had asked them to take care of a young boy whom he claimed was his son and went by the name Bobby. Bobby would have been around Melvin's age, and he did resemble him, but what was most interesting is that he appeared to have a jagged burn scar on his left thigh, similar to a birthmark Melvin had. The couple agreed to take Bobby in, but claimed that the oil worker suddenly showed up at their farm 4 months later and took Bobby away without even speaking to them or offering compensation for watching over the boy. Unfortunately, this lead did not go anywhere, but Roy Horst offered his own theory about what might have happened to his nephew. He did suspect that Melvin was abducted by bootleggers who wanted to send a message to him, but they did not anticipate just how much nationwide coverage the boy's disappearance would generate. While none of these bootleggers wanted to harm Melvin, they also feared potential consequences if he was returned to his family, so over the course of the next several years, the boy was passed back and forth between many different people. Things may have eventually reached the point where someone decided to raise Melvin under a new identity, and he forgot about his past life with his family. Indeed, the horse always remained hopeful that Melvin was still alive somewhere, unaware of who he really was. In 1943, Zora Hurst got a job working at a plant for the B.F. Goodrich Company, which was manufacturing equipment for World War II. By this point, Melvin's brother Ralph was serving overseas in Africa, and since Melvin would have been 19 years old at this point, Zora hoped he might also be serving his country under a different name and wanted to contribute to the war effort. Raymond, Zora, and Ralph Horst have all since passed away, but at the time of this recording, Melvin's younger sister Elgie is still alive at the age of 93 and still living in Orville. In fact, in July of 2019, Elgie was interviewed in an article about the case for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. In spite of all the time that has passed, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Orville Police Department are still working on this case, and DNA has been obtained from Elgie and some of Melvin's other surviving relatives and submitted to the state and national crime databases. The article also shared new information about Tony LaFatch, the bootlegger whom Charles Hanna had implicated in Melvin's disappearance. LaFatch died in 1994, but it turns out a woman had told the authorities that she cared for Melvin in an upstairs apartment in Akron shortly after he went missing. LaFatch then had the boy move to another location, and while the woman said she had no idea what happened to him afterward, investigators are still looking into this possible angle. During her interview, Elgie revealed that she still has the toy red truck Melvin had received for Christmas and left behind in the yard when he vanished. She eventually decided to give the truck to her own son, and the family has passed it down for generations and still keeps it as a reminder of Melvin after all these years. But sadly, there are still no definitive answers about what actually happened to him. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Native, for supporting The Trail Went Cold. The Christmas season is right around the corner, and I can tell you that for as long as I can remember, I've often found sticks of deodorant in my stocking on Christmas morning, but none of them have ever been as effective as Native. Native makes safe, simple, effective products that people use in the bathroom every day with trusted ingredients and trusted performance. Native can hang with you in any situation, whether it be your workout, a 16-hour day, and yes, even preparing for a hectic holiday season. It has fewer, simpler ingredients, so you always know everything that's in the deodorant, and it is also aluminum-free, safe, and effective. Native comes in a wide variety of enticing scents for both men and women, plus they release new, limited-edition seasonal scents throughout the year. And of course, there's also their classic deodorant scents, including coconut and vanilla, their most popular scent, lavender and rose, eucalyptus and mint, and cucumber and mint. Native also offers free returns and exchanges in the USA, and if you subscribe to them, you can save 17% and $2 per stick and have them conveniently delivered to your door every 1, 2, 3, or 4 months. As you probably know if you've heard my previous ads, my personal favorite brand is cucumber and mint because it makes me feel as cool as a cucumber, and it has such an enticing scent as well. I think it's very important to use a deodorant with clean ingredients, which is something which Native always guarantees, and they also offer an unscented formula and baking soda-free formula for those with sensitivities. And it goes without saying that Native deodorant makes for a great stocking stuffer. So get 20% off your first purchase of Native by visiting nativedeodorant.com and entering the promo code COLD during checkout. That's 20% off your first purchase by going to nativedeodorant.com and entering the promo code COLD. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. Man, here I was just digging up some unsolved cold cases which took place around Christmas time, and I thought this one would be interesting to cover on the podcast this month, but I really had no idea what a large rabbit hole I was diving into. I mentioned in the intro that Melvin Horse's disappearance was a pretty big deal at the time it originally took place, but I think the reason it isn't so well known today is because the Lindbergh baby kidnapping overshadowed it just a few years later. I mean, Charles Lindbergh was one of the most famous people in the world at that time, so you can understand why the abduction of his son would become one of the biggest criminal cases ever, but the Horse were just a normal, working-class family from a town of 4,500 people who probably never imagined being caught up in something like this. At least the Lindbergh case was a clear-cut ransom kidnapping, where one suspect was convicted and executed for his role in the crime, but even after the arrests of several people, two criminal trials, and a couple of confessions, no one is certain what the motive was for Melvin's disappearance or what ultimately happened to him. One of the reasons I often love doing older cases like this is to explore how much different criminal investigations and society in general were several decades ago. I love the detail of how the authorities organized a search effort for Melvin by ringing a fire bell to alert all of the town's residents that a child was missing, which I guess was pretty much the 1928 equivalent of an Amber Alert. And it's crazy to read that elementary school-aged children who were not much older than Melvin actively participated in the search, which would probably not fly today. There were times when it appeared that Melvin's disappearance was causing the entire community to go into hysteria. For instance, there was one incident where a woman from the nearby village of Seville saw a young boy playing in a front yard and flat out screamed, quote, "That's the missing Orville boy. I'm taking him home to his mother," end quote. She then tried to grab the boy, but was thwarted when his aunt and uncle just happened to arrive home at that exact moment. They had to get several different people from the neighborhood to finally convince this woman that the boy was not Melvin Horst. I mean, there's always a lot of paranoia whenever a child goes missing today, but back in 1928, I'd wager that most of the people living in Orville and the surrounding area had never seen anything like this before, which is why Melvin's mother had no qualms about letting her 4-year-old son go outside to play in the neighborhood without adult supervision. Now, the fact that Melvin's disappearance took place 2 days after Christmas is one of the most poignant elements of this story. I mentioned earlier that the Horse vowed not to take down their Christmas tree until after Melvin returned home, but it sounds like his disappearance completely ruined the holidays for the family. His sister Elgie said that she grew up not really celebrating Christmas too much because it was just too painful for her parents. And then there's the fact that Melvin had the toy truck he had just received for Christmas with him when he left the house, and this truck would become their final memory of him. If you go on YouTube, you can watch a clip of an interview with Elgie, which was conducted this past summer, and I gotta say, when Elgie said she still had her brother's truck after all these years, and they showed a clip of what I presumed to be one of her great-grandchildren playing with it, it put a major lump in my throat. This has to be one of the saddest, yet oddly heartwarming things I've ever seen in one of the cases I covered. But at the same time, I also wonder if that truck has any significance to the case, because it was found in the Horst's front yard. It was established that Melvin went to play with his friends in a vacant lot located just over a block away, and initially, it was assumed that Melvin was abducted while heading back home through a 1,000-foot alleyway. But if that's what happened, how did Melvin's truck wind up in his front yard? What's frustrating is that I've read so many contradictory accounts about the exact details of how Melvin went missing, and some sources even mistakenly refer to the truck as a toy wagon. What isn't clear is whether or not Melvin had the truck with him when he went to play in the lot. If he didn't, then he probably left the truck behind in his yard, and it means nothing. But if he did, does that mean Melvin made it all the way to his front yard before he was abducted? If it's the latter, then I can't see how the Arnold family was even arrested in the first place, since that would completely discredit the story about them abducting Melvin from the alleyway. On that note, I think now would be a good time to talk about the Arnolds and the star witness in the case against them, Junior Hannah, who, despite being 8 years old, has to be one of the most enigmatic figures ever featured on my podcast. It's just insane how much chaos this young kid's stories would cause over the next 2 years. The one thing which seems certain is that something happened to Melvin while he was heading home shortly after 5:15 p.m. I guess you also have to acknowledge the possibility that Melvin might have wandered off somewhere and died an accidental death, either from exposure or drowning in a body of water, but the area was thoroughly searched, and Melvin was playing only about a block away from his house, and walking a route he likely would have taken many times before, so I really think the only explanation is that he was abducted. The most prominent theory is that Melvin's disappearance was some sort of revenge scheme against his town marshal uncle, Roy Horst, who had made enemies with a number of bootleggers by rigidly enforcing prohibition. There was a lot of suspicion that the people responsible were under the mistaken impression that Melvin was Roy's son. Of course, the biggest problem with this theory is that no one ever heard from the kidnappers, so if they were attempting to send some sort of message to Roy, they didn't exactly convey that. But this could be explained by the fact that the story escalated into something much larger than anyone could have anticipated. Remember, Orrville was a town of only 4,500 people, but once the newspapers learned of Melvin's disappearance, it wound up garnering nationwide headlines that could have terrified the perpetrators. Roy himself would push forward the theory that the kidnappers just had no idea what to do. They didn't have the stomach to murder a 4-year-old boy, but they also didn't want to run the risk of returning him either, in case Melvin might reveal some incriminating information about them. So the only solution was pretty much playing hot potato with the kid and passing him off between many different people until he became somebody else's problem. I know it was initially theorized that Melvin was the victim of a ransom kidnapping because he was mistaken for the son of a wealthy neighbor. While the idea was discounted because no ransom demand was ever sent, I wouldn't completely write it off. Even if the kidnappers mistook Melvin for another boy, they still may have been taken aback by all the publicity the case generated and became too paranoid to return him. If Melvin was passed around a lot, this might explain all the reported sightings of him with different people over the years. So now we have to look at potential suspects, starting with the Arnold family, who were arrested only a week after Melvin went missing. At the outset, I can definitely see why everyone would be inclined to think they did it. The family weren't exactly model citizens, as they had been arrested by Roy Horst for bootlegging, and they lived in very close proximity to where Melvin went missing. But the problem is that there was nothing else to implicate them other than the testimony of an 8-year-old who changed his story multiple times. And sadly, it became apparent that all law enforcement cared about was closing the case and getting a conviction, even when compelling evidence surfaced that Junior Hanna's story wasn't true. They may have legitimately believed the Arnolds were guilty at the time they were originally arrested, but it seems like they weren't willing to backtrack once the case started to fall apart. The biggest red flag is that Junior's original story was that he saw both Arthur Arnold and Bascom McHenry abducting Melvin, but once it turned out that Bascom had an alibi, placing him at another location, it appeared that detectives pressured Junior into changing his statement. And the bit about Melvin being abducted after he took a bite out of an orange is one of the most farcical things I've ever seen in a police investigation. You could almost call this Making a Murderer 1928 style. Instead of allegations that the police planted blood and DNA evidence on a suspect's property, here, they apparently planted an orange. I'm totally cracking up at the visual of a police detective taking a bite out of an orange, casually dropping it on the ground, and then saying, "Hey, look what I found!" And if you're trying to fabricate evidence against someone, you should also try to make sure everyone's on the same page, since a patrolman testified that he searched the property right after Melvin went missing and was pretty certain there was no orange there. But is it possible that the Arnolds still could have been responsible for Melvin's disappearance and there just wasn't the evidence to prove it? Well, since the other family members had solid alibis, Elias and Arthur were the only ones who could have done it, and technically, their only alibis were for each other, since they claimed they were home together between 4:50 and 5:30 p.m. But what's not clear is what their exact alibis were after that. Yes, they technically had enough time to abduct Melvin during that window, but they still would have needed time to get rid of him, and if the Arnolds' whereabouts were accounted for after 5:30, then I don't know how they could have done this. I really doubt that the Arnolds were involved, and even if they were, the case against them was incredibly weak, so the jury definitely made the right decision to acquit Elias and Arthur at their second trial. As an aside, it's crazy to see how much quicker the justice system used to move back in those days, as the Arnolds' arrest, first trial, the overturning of their convictions, and their second trial all took place within the same calendar year. So now we have to talk about the arrests of Charles Hanna Sr. and Earl Conald after Junior Hanna implicated his own father in Melvin's disappearance. Quite frankly, I find it astounding that police would arrest these guys strictly on the basis of Junior's story after the boy had already been proven to be a liar at the Arnolds' trial. I mean, can you imagine the reaction today if police made two separate arrests in a high-profile criminal case on no evidence besides the word of a child? I'm sure the media would be making a lot of boy-who-cried-wolf analogies. To be fair, Junior claimed that the only reason he implicated the Arnolds in the first place was because Charles Sr. told him to, and I'm sure it would have been hard to fathom a boy going so far as to falsely accuse his own father of abducting and potentially murdering a child. But the problem is that the police could not find any other corroborating evidence to implicate Charles or Earl, and could only charge them after some very questionable confessions. Now, in this day and age, we all know that false confessions are one of the biggest causes of wrongful convictions, and that anyone is capable of confessing to a crime they didn't commit under intense interrogation. Obviously, people weren't as well versed about false confessions 90 years ago, but it's so interesting to look at this particular case from a modern perspective. The biggest reason people will falsely confess is because they just want to make their ordeal stop, so they'll tell their interrogators exactly what they want to hear. Here, we have Charles Hanna Sr. being grilled for 36 consecutive hours before he feeds them a false story about killing Melvin and burying the body in his backyard. He knows that the police are going to perform a search and not find anything, but in the meantime, at least he could get a couple hours sleep, and when they wake him up and start interrogating him again, he just feeds them another story. But now we have no idea how truthful any of his confessions might be. And given that marks were also found on Charles's thumbs, it's possible he was tortured in order to get him to talk. We have contradictory stories of Charles and Earl accusing the other of luring Melvin into the garage and harming him, and then Charles claimed he was acting under the orders of bootlegger Tony LaFatch and handed Melvin over to LaFatch's goons. Now, if you do a search on Tony LaFatch at newspapers.com, you'll find a number of matches for his name, as he had a long career in organized crime and did numerous stints in prison for various offenses. They couldn't find any evidence that LaFatch was involved in Melvin's disappearance at that time, but the fact that they mentioned his name in the recent article about the case published this past summer does suggest that there's a reason to believe he might have orchestrated this whole thing. Here's the thing. I don't believe the Arnold family was involved, but I also think it's somewhat plausible that Charles Hanna would have instructed his son to falsely accuse them since they were rival bootleggers. If that's not what happened, then what could have compelled Junior Hanna to falsely accuse the Arnolds and then falsely accuse his own father? We're talking about an 8-year-old kid here, and while children do lie sometimes, this goes beyond the extreme. While they were able to tear apart and disprove Junior's story about witnessing the Arnolds abduct Melvin, they were unable to do the same thing to his story about escorting Melvin to a garage where Charles and Earl were waiting. It's possible that Junior left immediately after delivering Melvin to them and legitimately had no idea what happened to Melvin afterward. The one part which makes me think there might be some truth to the claims that Tony LaFatch was involved is that he willingly admitted to being in Orville that day, he drove a green car around that time, and witnesses recalled seeing a green car with a woman and a crying child in the back seat. That detail is particularly interesting, since a female acquaintance of LaFatch's apparently said that she watched over Melvin for several days at an apartment in Akron before the boy was moved to another location. But on the other hand, the sighting of the green car completely contradicts Charles's story about turning Melvin's body over to two men who work for LaFatch, so perhaps that sighting has no significance. One thing I find amusing is that after the police questioned LaFatch and released him from custody, he apparently said he was going to file a lawsuit against Charles for falsely accusing him, as organized crime figures are known for doing much worse to people who snitch on them than suing them. Now, as for what motive LaFatch might have had for kidnapping Melvin, the most obvious one is that he wanted revenge on Roy Horst for enforcing prohibition and harming his bootlegging business. But much like Elias Arnold, LaFatch flat out stated that he would not harm a child in order to send a message to one of his enemies, and he also laughed at Charles's claim that he would have paid him 25 gallons of liquor just to deliver a boy, which, considering how much that amount of liquor would have been worth during the Prohibition era, is a valid point. LaFatch also operated in Akron, which is located in an entirely different county nearly 30 miles away from Orrville, so it's questionable just how much of a dent Roy would have made in LaFatch's business for him to orchestrate something like this. But again, this may have originally just been intended as a temporary abduction in order to frighten Roy before they returned the boy unharmed, but after the story garnered nationwide attention, everyone involved became incredibly paranoid and just kept transferring Melvin around between different people while they figured out what to do. I must say, that scenario is pretty unique for a missing children's case. In most situations where a child is abducted, the most likely explanation is that they were the victim of a predator who murdered them shortly thereafter. Yet this seems to be the polar opposite, where a boy was kidnapped by people who did not want to harm him, but just got themselves in way too deep. Obviously, you can't just keep moving a child around indefinitely, but Melvin was only 4 years old, and this whole situation must have been incredibly confusing at his age. If he ever wound up in the hands of someone who wanted to raise him permanently, he was still young enough that he could have blocked out all memories of his past life with his family and forgotten who he really was. I can see why Melvin's family often liked to push that scenario, as it gave them hope that he was still alive and living under a new identity somewhere. I mean, during World War II, they started speculating about the possibility of him being overseas serving his country under a different name, so it would be pretty crazy if he was killed in action and no one even realized it. An interesting angle to this theory is that Melvin's disappearance took place only 8 months before the Great Depression sent the entire country into chaos. Over the course of the next several years, it was not uncommon for parents to wind up in a position where they felt they had to give their children away or leave them in someone else's care because they simply could not afford to provide for them. Therefore, a boy being passed around several times between different people was not going to draw as much attention as it ordinarily would have. No one was automatically going to suspect that Melvin was a kidnapped child, and it's easy to imagine him being lost in the shuffle among the many children who were passed around during the Great Depression. There were numerous sightings of Melvin in the company of other people over the years, and I'd wager that most of them were from witnesses who saw another boy and simply mistook him for Melvin. But a few of them, such as the couple who looked after a boy at their farm in the spring of 1929, were fairly convincing, since these witnesses described a jagged burn scar which resembled a birthmark Melvin had on his left thigh. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about one last theory which doesn't get discussed too much, since the only source where I've seen it mentioned is an article from the April 9th, 1961 edition of the Akron Beacon Journal. The article contained an interview with Robert Van Steenburg, a veteran captain with the Akron Police Department, who revealed his own personal theory about what happened to Melvin, and it's pretty convoluted, so bear with me. On February the 11th, 1929, a man entered a doctor's office in Akron and received treatment for a gunshot wound to the leg, but he refused to provide his name and address before he left. The doctor had one of his nurses follow the man to a nearby apartment house before he contacted the police. Robert Van Steenburg, a young detective at the time, was assigned to investigate this, and when he visited the man's apartment, a woman claiming to be his wife and a frightened-looking young boy were also there. The man claimed his name was Aaron Shamblin, but he refused to reveal how he was shot, so he was taken down to the police station for questioning. The following day, Van Steenburgh claimed that an attorney showed up at his house and tried to bribe him $500 to release Shamblin. Van Steenburgh refused the offer and told the attorney to get out, but would later find out that someone had arranged to have Shamblin released later that day. Van Steenburgh decided to return to Shamblin's apartment and discovered that the woman was there, but Shamblin and the boy were gone. The woman told Van Steenburgh that she was not actually Shamblin's wife, and that two tough-looking men had asked Shamblin to watch over this boy because, quote-unquote, his parents were getting a divorce. When one of the men later returned, Shamblin refused to give the boy back, and an argument ensued, which is how he wound up getting shot in the leg. The woman soon disappeared herself, but it wasn't long before Van Steenburgh became convinced that this mysterious boy was Melvin Horst. Anyway, in 1937, a boy who appeared to be around 13 years old was shot to death inside a cabin in Journey's End, Kentucky. The shooting was a tragic accident, as the cabin owner's daughter had been playing with her father's pistol before she inadvertently pulled the trigger and fired a bullet into the boy's heart. The boy had visited the cabin with a circus worker named Hayden Romaine, who claimed that the boy was a runaway he had taken into his care months earlier. Romaine said he called him Bud, but the kid did not actually seem to know his real name, and when he could not be identified, he was buried as an unknown child. Well, when Robert Van Steenburgh got wind of the story, he decided to explore the possibility that the boy might be Melvin Horst. When he showed Hayden Romaine a mugshot of the mysterious Aaron Shamblin, Romaine actually recognized him and claimed he had seen the man hanging around circuses in the past. And it also turned out that the deceased boy had what appeared to be a burn scar on his left thigh, which matched the birthmark Melvin had. Van Steenburgh decided to show photos of the 13-year-old boy to Melvin's parents, and while they acknowledged that the boy might be Melvin, they could not positively identify him. But during his aforementioned interview in 1961, Van Steenburgh expressed his personal belief that the boy was Melvin, but he just lacked the evidence to prove it. Now, personally, I believe this is a lead which is worth revisiting. Obviously, since this boy was believed to be around 13 years old and there was no DNA testing in 1937, there really wasn't much one could do to conclusively prove if he was Melvin or not. Since Melvin was just 4 years old when he went missing, I'm not sure he would have had any dental records, and the only thing to suggest that the boy might be him was a similar-looking scar on his left thigh. Of course, at that time, the Horst were still holding on to the hope that their son was still alive somewhere, so I'm not sure they were going to positively identify this kid as being Melvin without concrete proof. Since the DNA of Melvin's surviving relatives is now on file, I would love it if they could exhume this boy and use DNA testing to determine if he's Melvin or not. But here's an additional complication. Even though this boy was originally shot, killed, and buried in Journey's End, Kentucky, a couple from Masontown, Pennsylvania soon identified him as their missing son, so his body was exhumed, transferred to Masontown, and reburied at St. Agnes Cemetery there. But then weeks later, the couple's son actually resurfaced and turned out to be alive, so the deceased boy wound up becoming an unidentified John Doe again. As far as I know, the boy is probably still buried at St. Agnes Cemetery in Masontown, but I can't be 100% certain, and if they wanted to track down his body for DNA testing, I hope they wouldn't have difficulties finding him. Even if this particular kid is not Melvin, and he is not the same person as the boy seen in Akron in February of 1929, that lead is still compelling on its own. Van Steenburgh claimed that as hard as he tried, he could find no record anywhere of a man named Aaron Shamblin, so there's a good chance that was not his real name. But I'm intrigued by the idea of this Shamblin watching over Melvin and not wanting to give him back to the people who originally abducted him, so they spent the next couple of years on the run together before they somehow eventually went their separate ways. In the end, however, much like with most of the other theories in the case, there really isn't enough conclusive evidence to support this one. It's crazy to look over all the twists and turns in this story. We've had a number of people arrested over the unreliable testimony of an 8-year-old. We've had an organized crime figure linked to the case through nothing more than hearsay. And we've had many reported sightings of Melvin in the company of other adults over the years, but nothing to definitively prove it was him. Honestly, for all this talk about how Melvin was abducted in order to send a message to someone before he was repeatedly passed around for years, it would not surprise me at all if the actual truth is a lot more straightforward. Perhaps Melvin was simply kidnapped by a predator who murdered him and disposed of his body, and the investigation was so focused on the angles involving bootlegging and organized crime that the real perpetrator managed to slip through the cracks. Remember, the abduction and murder of children by sexual predators was just not as common an occurrence back then, so it's likely that a number of people never even considered or were just unwilling to explore that possibility. But since no evidence of foul play was ever found, this theory isn't any more likely or unlikely than the others. Part of me believes that there are elements of truth to the story that Charles Hanna, Earl Connold, and Tony LaFatch were involved in Melvin's disappearance, but the entire investigation just turned into such a train wreck that it was impossible to conclusively determine what happened. I do believe there is a good possibility that Melvin was still alive for a period of time following his disappearance, and the best case scenario is that he wound up with someone who raised him under a new identity, and he went on to live a long life. This idea of an abducted boy being passed around by several different people who had no idea what to do with him might seem absurd today, but I could see something like that happening in the era of the Great Depression, and hopefully, things never reached the point where someone finally decided that Melvin was too much of a liability and killed him. If Melvin Horst is still alive today, he would be 95 years old, so the odds are not good that he's still out there. But it's also possible that Melvin lived a long life under a new identity after he went missing, and might be buried somewhere under a different name. Since the DNA from Melvin's surviving relatives has been entered into a database, maybe a miracle will occur, and we'll see a match someday. For most of the cases I've covered on the podcast, which are this old, there is usually no need for me to provide my obligatory disclaimer about contacting the appropriate authorities if you have any information, but since the Oroville Police Department is still actively investigating this case, if you happen to know anything which could help lead this case to closure, please contact them at 330-684-5025. That's 330-684-5025. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, our bonus episode covers a very rare final appeal case, which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, about the controversial conviction of Thomas Drake for the attempted murder of his wife, Nancy Drake. And for our patrons in tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are M.A., Sean, Peggy K., Anna T., Christine H., Kelly S., Dave, Julian K., and Spooky, who signed up for a particularly generous monthly pledge. So thank you all so much for your support. Also, just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another holiday-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. Hey.
Bye.